TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I do miss putting a magazine together. I miss working with photographers on editorial stories. But I don't feel it's relevant. I don't feel it's the proper tool to communicate fashion today.
From the TED Audio Collective, this is Design Matters with Debbie Millman. For 17 years, Debbie Millman has been talking with designers and other creative people about what they do, how they got to be who they are, and what they're thinking about and working on. On this episode, Fabien Baron talks about his career as an art director and about the decline of fashion magazines.
I mean, with all my clients, we don't talk about the page that's going to go in Vogue. We talk about, like, the Instagram post.
Creative director is a catch-all job description. In the case of Fabien Baron, it doesn't catch all that he has done in his illustrious career. He's designed some of the world's biggest and most prestigious publications. He's designed books and perfume bottles and furniture. He's shot and directed films. He's created some of the most memorable ad campaigns of the last 40 years for clients including Calvin Klein and Dior and Balenciaga. And he's created singular, groundbreaking looks for Harper's Bazaar, Vogue Italia, and Interview. Vanity Fair once called him the most sought-after creative director in the world. And indeed, he is. Today, he joins me on Zoom from Paris, France. Fabien Baron, welcome to Design Matters. Bonjour.
Bonjour. You have such a lovely voice.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Fabien, the photographer Glenn Lutchford has insisted that you are the Elvis Presley of graphic design.
Oh, my God.
And I'm wondering if you know why he stated that.
No, I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't.
You don't. Do you know that he even said it?
Well, no, I know Glenn quite well. I mean, from those days, the back days when I was at Harper's Bazaar. And I hired him to work on the magazine and to do some stories. And there was one story, actually, that he did that I really liked. He did with Kate Moss going around the city and 42nd Street and just, like, taking very, like, reportage type of pictures that were, like, really amazing. That's how I met with Glenn.
Yeah. Maybe it's the breakthrough, groundbreaking part that he was referring to. Fabien, your father, Marc Baron, was a legendary art director in Paris. He worked mainly with two publications. He was the founding art director of the left-wing daily Libération and the sports daily L'Equipe. Is it true that you were a newspaper delivery boy for Libération?
Well, not delivery boy, but, you know, I worked under my father, so I was really the go-to guy to do anything at the magazine. It would be doing at the time, like, photo stats, which were, like, you know, taking the pictures and blow them up different sizes.
Yeah.
I was a stat girl
at my student newspaper in college.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
Good. So
yes.
I used to do that. And I used to do like mechanicals and like putting all the mechanics of the mechanical part of the magazine like on pages, you know. And I was doing a lot of letter sets. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yeah, I still do just for fun.
I used to be really good at it. I used to be really good because you had to pick the size. You couldn't be like, you had to be 100%. So I used to be really good at it. I could type something like exactly to the length I want in the size of, by just guessing. So it was a fun game.
Knowing that about you now, I could see how that training helped in the creation of some of your typographic constructions. You know, there is a sort of puzzling to them and placing them all together in a way that if I don't think you knew how to do that by hand, you wouldn't be able to do it on the computer.
Yes. Actually, the first time I did this kind of graphics, I did it with a Xerox machine. So, and that was really at Italian Vogue at the time, like everything, we didn't have computers or anything. So we had to work everything kind of like manually. So I used to take the font and use the Xerox machine and blow them up on the Xerox machine and like collage the pieces by cutting them out, basically.
You said that your father was super bright, super smart, and very educated. But I also understand that he was quite hard on you in your early days as a designer. In what way?
I guess he wanted me to learn and learn the proper way, but also learn the hard way, because he wanted to make sure this is something I was going to do and something I was going to love. And, and when it's hard and you're still in love, that means it sticks, right? So I guess it was really tough in the way that we used to work. I was responsible for everything. Every time there was a mistake, it was me, even though it was not me. So he just wanted me to be responsible for everything. So it was quite like not very gentle, let's say. And I guess at the time, you know, like it was not like it is now. Like now it's, you have to be extremely gentle with people. And you have to be like extremely polite, extremely proper. He was not like that with me, at least.
I read that your father felt that the objective of graphic design was to get the reader involved with the editorial content of the publication. And you talk about this quite a lot. But at the time, you were also reading Francine Cresson's French Vogue, and you were enthralled by the photography of Helmut Newton and Guy Bourdin. Did you feel that that was in conflict with what your dad was teaching you?
No, actually, I didn't feel like it was in conflict. I think it was good, like a proper balance. I think like his teaching was quite journalistic. It was quite like classic journalism. And at the same time, I felt like having access to magazine like French Vogue and, you know, like, and all these photographers and looking at those visuals, I was really intrigued how you would create such visuals. So it was something that I was really like very like looking after, like almost like, you know, like I would devour those magazines when they would show up in the house, because they were like, you know, the visuals were exceptional. And I really had no idea you would put this type of visuals together, how you would create them. I mean, the photography part and after, like how you would like come up with those ideas, those concepts and everything. So it was like really like I was looking at that in extremely intrigued. At the same time, what was important at the time, especially in newspapers, is to pass the information the proper way and, you know, like to make sure like the reader would understand what you're trying to say.
After a gigantic fight, I understand you left home and his supervision and you moved into your own apartment. And at that point, you stated that he was still your hero and you still looked up to him, but it took years before you were both fully reconciled. What did you fight about?
I don't remember. I don't remember what the fight was about, but I know that I left that day. I don't recall at all. I mean, isn't it the case? Most of the time, you don't remember what the fight is about. What you remember is like, did I leave or didn't I leave? Yes, I did. I definitely left. And it was a while before, like, you know, not that long either, because, you know, I liked him and he liked me. I was quite upset. I was not so happy about it, to be honest. It's not a good memory, that part. But it was time for me to go. I mean, some kids, they leave their parents nicely and some don't leave their parents nicely.
Ultimately, you've said that the relationship with your father gave you a sense of how to treat people.
Yes.
What do you feel that he most taught you in that regard?
I think what he really gave me is a good sense of what this job was about. A good sense of being a deep down, you have to remain a journalist to a certain degree. In anything you do, you have to make, it's got to make sense, it's got to be understood, and it's got to be clear. But also, I think he gave me discipline and a work ethic that I don't think I would have gotten if it was not through him. The level of discipline in which I work is quite surprising for some people. I've heard it. I'm very keen, and it's a search to perfection, into kind of like trying to really find that place, which is difficult to find, that really, I think like perfection is quite a good word. Even though I've understood that you cannot obtain perfection, but you can come close to it, and it is because you can't obtain it that you continue to search for it. But, you know, like that puts you into a certain category of people that you understand that this becomes your life and that you're going to be a professional about it, a little bit like an athlete. You know, like I'd do anything to make it right, basically. Just like an athlete would wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning if they need to train.
Right.
So I'm very similar. I'm ready to do anything to make this right. So part of why I get results is because of that discipline. I think if I wouldn't have that discipline, I wouldn't have done that many things. I would have been very hesitant into trying new mediums. And I think it's that rigor, but also that need and that search to perfection that allowed me to experiment and to try new medium quite easily without hesitation.
You attended arts appliques in Paris for a year before dropping out. What made you decide to leave school at that point?
I felt I was wasting my time. I knew pretty much what I wanted to do. And I don't know if I wanted to be an art director because my dad was an art director and I wanted to show him that I'd be a better art director than him, or if it was because I really knew I had a calling. So, I mean, that one I still cannot answer, really. But I knew what I wanted to do. That's for sure. So knowing so clearly what I wanted to do, I didn't want it to waste my time. So even though I had a good time that year and I had very good friends and it was like kind of lovely to be at school and to experiment different experiences and do different work because like there's art appliqué, they teach you graphics, photography, textile, you know, drawing, painting, modeling, you know, like they do so many different things that, you know, and that was quite, you know, interesting. I didn't feel I needed to do it. I needed to work right away. I was already, even with my father helping him doing certain things. So I felt like, you know, like I'm going to do this for a couple of years. I'm going to waste my time and as well go to work and like go at it right away and really learn the real job that I want to do.
You also got your first camera when you were 17 years old, and you've stated that while art direction is how you make your living, photography remains your personal love.
Yes.
What motivated you to become a professional creative director versus becoming a professional photographer at that time in your life?
I guess that's my father. You know, like, I think my father would have been an architect. I probably would have said, like, I want to be an architect. I think that's what it is, because, you know, right now you would tell me, would you like to be an architect? I would say yes. I mean, there's so many things I would like to be. And I think like the mediums of anything that touches with art in general, they kind of like all kind of overlap. I learned throughout the years and experimenting with different mediums that actually the most important thing is not, you know, the medium itself. It's more the point of view that you have, and now you want to express it. And certain mediums are easier to express your point of view than others. So the photography was something that I felt really close to myself, probably because of those French photographers, the Guy Bourdin, the Newton that I was looking at. And actually, the first time I got my camera, the things I was doing is I was going with my sister around, like trying to do like a Guy Bourdin picture. Yeah, it like, I would make a pose in something very similar. And like, I would do pictures like that with saturated colors. And I didn't have a flash, so it didn't work perfectly. But I was experimenting and wanted, like, I was really intrigued by the imagery side of magazines rather than the journalistic side of magazines. So my training was being very journalistic. There was this other side that actually was not taught by my dad. That was the old process of image making. And that started by taking pictures for myself. And then as I went along, it got more and more. I got involved on the art directing side of making an image. Then I became the art director that was good with type and good with images. So there was a definite conflict because of the photographers and the level of photographers that I ended up working on later on for me to also be a photographer.
Right.
There was kind of like a conflict of interest to some degree. Like, why this guy is being on set with us? He's seeing everything we do, and then he's going to go take pictures, and maybe he's going to take pictures like us. So there was like this kind of conflict going on, and I wanted to be really respectful of that. So I never really involved myself as a photographer in my early years as an art director. It's much, much, much later on that I decided, okay, but maybe I should do a story. And that step was a really hard step for me to take.
Why?
Because of what I just told you, like the conflict, that conflict of interest. I was afraid that photographers would start seeing me as, you know, a competition rather than seeing me as someone helping them.
Did you find that that was the case?
No. No, it was not. It was all in my head, I guess. So yeah. So in the meantime, I did a lot of personal work. That's why I put myself doing like, you know, landscape photography and start doing work of, you know, that was not fashion related. And it was like at the same time, I mean, like it just happened to be that way. I think it was good because it allowed me to experiment something else. Something that was not fashion, something that was not related to a model and related to style.
Yeah. But, well, you've said that when you are confronted with restrictions, you sometimes do your best work. And so maybe this restriction of not doing photography in fashion gave you this opportunity to explore something that you wouldn't have otherwise.
Yes. I'm also forced myself into doing the step and repeat, meaning like taking a picture and going over and taking the same picture, and kind of trying to look for that perfection of it and to see like the difference between each one of them.
So I would say that your ocean pictures certainly do that.
They certainly do that. And they've been going on since 1983. And I still catch myself doing sometimes.
In 1982, a girl you knew from New York came to visit you in Paris, and you ended up falling in love. You then decided to move with her back to New York, so you sold your motorcycle, you sublet your apartment, and with only $300 in your pocket, you moved to New York City.
That's correct.
Was living in New York something you had always hoped to do, or was this a spontaneous decision after falling in love?
The way I grew up in France, I mean, actually, the way most kids my age grew up in France, they were quite Americanized in many ways. Like, you know, the music was coming from the States and from London. The movies were all coming from America. The culture was very much an American culture. And anything that was new was coming from there. So I felt I was not, you know, when you're not part, you're not in the courtyard with the other kids playing. I felt I was in the other courtyard, you know, basically getting the scraps from the good courtyard. When, you know,
I know that feeling well.
I thought it was much better to just check it out in the U.S., especially New York. There was like this aura around it, around the New York at that time, like in the 80s. That was really, that was really amazing. And I just wanted to go there.
Yeah. I'm a native New Yorker, but I didn't move to Manhattan until 1983. So I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm about a year or so behind you. And New York at that point seemed to be sort of this mystical, magical place. Aside from your girlfriend, you knew only one person in New York, the great Véronique Vien. She's also been on the show, the art director at the time from Women's Wear Daily. How did she help you? Did she help you sort of get settled in the magazine community?
What happened is actually, I was freelancing in this magazine in France, this fashion magazine in France. And Véronique Vien was asked to come and redesign the magazine. And when she came, she had a, you know, graphic formula. And, you know, right away, I kind of like, you know, attacked her and like, you know, like worked with her like really rapidly and tried to show my skill. And like she was really impressed that I would understand so quickly what she wanted to do. We got on the right foot, but rapidly I told her, you know, like, I really want to come to New York. I really want to come to New York. Can I come to New York? You know, so I bugged her to come to New York. And she basically invited me. I mean, she had very little choice. I was like relentless. Like, I got to come to...
What a surprise.
So she invited me, even though she was about to move to California. And she invited me, and I stayed with her, and I worked at Women's Wear Daily, and I was kind of like an intern there, and I stayed 2 months. And then I went back to France. In the meantime, during my time in New York, I met this girl that you're mentioning. And a year later, she showed up in Paris, and that's when I decided, oh, let's go back to New York and check it out. And I went back, and then I just knew her and her partner at the time, Carl Lehman Haupt. I had $300. I called him up, and, you know, Véronique Vien was already in San Francisco, so she was not part of this. But, like, he basically organized a meeting for me with a couple of people in New York. But one of the meetings was actually with Alex Lieberman.
Yes.
So, which was like a great meeting. And I knew who he was. I was very impressed by who he was and at the meeting. And when I came see him, at the time, he was on the Vogue floor. He had an office there. You know, like we met and he spoke French right away. He said, on parle français. Ce sera plus facile. And he was right, because my English at the time, let me tell you, was not that good. So we spoke in French, and he was very fond of French people and very fond of my work, because I've showed him my portfolio at the time. And he said, what do you want to do? I said, I would like to become an art director. I would like to work in magazines. You know, I'd love to work at Condé Nast. And he said, well, have you heard of this magazine? We're starting this new magazine. It's called Vanity Fair. It would be very nice if you want to meet with the art director and see if you guys get along. So he sent me to, at the time, the art director was Lloyd Ziff. And I met with him and we talked and he liked me very much. And logically, I had the job. But then I got a phone call from Alex Lieberman and said, well, Lloyd Ziff is not going to stay with us any longer, so the Vanity Fair gig is not going to happen. Don't disappear. I'm going to find you some, you got to stick around here. I'm going to find you something else in the meantime. And then he put me at Self Magazine.
Yeah. So I graduated college in 1983. And in 1982, Vanity Fair had been relaunched. And I thought it was the most glorious magazine in recent history. Just the idea that this was a beautiful arts and literary magazine, that David Hockney's socks and feet were put on the cover, Philip Roth was on the cover. I desperately wanted to work at Vanity Fair as well. And being a very young designer coming from a state school in New York, I knew the chances were very slim. But I sent my portfolio into Condé Nast as well. This is 1983, so this is a year later after you. And I got a call back from Charles Churchward, who was then the art director.
That's correct. Yes.
I didn't meet with Charles, though. I met with human resources, and the human resources woman did not like me, so I didn't get the job. But the idea that the art director at the time, you know, thought there was something in my portfolio really, really buoyed me for quite a long time. So it's so funny how life has its circuitous turns. One thing I didn't know about you at all and had no idea, Fabian, I read that your first job in New York was actually at Johnson & Johnson, working
That's
on
correct.
A new design for their internal magazine. I was shocked when that I learned correct. This. So how did that happen?
That's through my friend Carlyman Hope to gave that job to me. He said, oh, I heard like Johnson & Johnson, they're trying to do an internal magazine and they need the design. And I did the, you know, like the zero for them, and it was great. It was like paid in cash.
Nice. Speaking of yes. being paid in cash, after looking at your portfolio, didn't Alexander Lieberman love your photography so much that he ended up buying $3,000 worth of photography of the Brooklyn Bridge?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
During that meeting also, like, you know, there were like, you know, all the work I'd done in France in magazine, but there was also like the pictures I'd taken, right. you know, myself and some of them in New York. And he saw these Brooklyn Bridge pictures, and they were doing an article in House and Garden on the Brooklyn Bridge. And I think it was for the Centennial or something like that at the time. I don't know exactly. Probably it got to be for that. But like, I remember, like, you know, they said, oh, you got to go see Rochelle Udell. She works at House and Garden. Let me give her a ring, and you got to go to see her and show her those pictures. So I went to see Rochelle Udell. She was at House and Garden, and she looked at the pictures and she said, oh, these are lovely. Can we keep them for a little bit? Then it took like 4 or 5 pictures. And then, you know, I get a phone call from Condé Nast saying like, oh, actually, like the pictures that they're going to be running. Oh, really? Yeah. And they paid like $3,000. And, you know, I was like, you must be kidding. I couldn't believe. So basically, that was my first experience as a photographer working for a publication in America.
And then when you went to Self, you also worked with Rochelle Udell. Is that correct?
She also worked for the magazine. She became a little bit like a miniature Alex Lieberman. She was working in, I think, in GQ. She had Self magazine. I think she was also up at Mademoiselle.
Yeah.
She was kind of like Alex Lieberman's right hand.
Yeah.
And she would come in and look over all the pages. And then Lieberman would come in and look at the pages. And we had to make sure like everything was well organized, like each picture was supposed to be from this side, which was very small, to a double page side. And then he would play with things.
Incredible.
It was really like my time at Self magazine in GQ, working with Mary Shanahan as the art director at GQ. And my time at Self magazine really like couldn't wait for these moments where Lieberman would show up and Rochelle would show up, kind of like shuffling everything around. Some part of it probably just to shuffle, and part of it to make more sense of the stories. I learned so much about like what you can do with a story, like how you can, with editing, with sizing, with putting things one way and another, why would that be better? And that to me, like, tied it up so nicely with all the things that I learned from my dad about the journalistic side of how you put something together so it's complete, so it makes sense, so there's a logic to it, but there's also an artistry about it. When I was there at Self, and you know, it's not that Self was a fantastic magazine, that's when I really like said, wow, I'm really liking this. I was eating it up like there was no tomorrow. And I loved it. And like when Alex would come, you know, like some of the designers would put pages together and like, you know, I was this smaller guy in the corner. And I would think like, I wonder how Lieberman's going to change that. Maybe he's going to do this. Maybe he's going to do that. It was really like intriguing to see him come and change everything around.
What an education.
The most intriguing part was that every time he was right. People were so upset. You have no idea. The designers were like crying over, like, the, you know, not crying literally, but like, you know, like so upset that the layouts were changed and everything. And I was thinking, but he's right. And we had arguments. I had arguments with some of the staff. I remember like, but it's much better. It makes sense. Now it makes sense. The story is better. And people like, they get like really like attached to their own work, I guess.
Yeah. What a magnificent thing to be able to witness and to learn and be part of. Alex moved you to GQ, and you mentioned that you worked with art director Mary Shanahan. And I read that you've said that she helped you clearly understand how an image can function.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that means and what she taught you.
Well, I think she was the one who just put the period on top of the I by saying a few things, like pushing this idea of the point of view, that everything comes down to a point of view. Everything comes down to a vision and to a way to express that vision in a very simple manner. And I think that I learned that from her. And she was very, very definite about that.
Mm-hmm.
That I think like really like I felt like, oh, I've complete the circle here. Like I have the understanding of like how to pass information in a proper way, in a practical way from my father and being a journalist. I understood the artistry and the shuffling and what you can do with an image and how you can say something in this way, if you make the image this size, or in this way, if you make the image this size, a little bit like the complete approach to the buildup of a magazine. But then I learned from Mary that, oh, this is great, but what is it that is inside the image? And what is that point of view? And how to pass on that information as an art director into the photographer so that point of view is palatable, relevant and on point. And after that, I felt like, ooh, I can be an art director.
You'd earn your stripes.
and then I left Condé Nast.
I know.
And then Lieberman was really pissed.
So after a year and a half at GQ, Betsy Carter, the former editor of Esquire and the newly minted editor of a brand new magazine called New York Woman, invited you to become the founding art director. And I remember when the magazine first came out, I actually had a friend who worked there as a copy editor, and there was so much excitement about the launch. And I read that you had many epic battles over the tone of the magazine. You wanted it to be cool and clean, and they wanted it to be warm and cozy, which seemed very odd for a New York woman type magazine. How did you manage, looking back on it, how would you describe that time?
Well, wow, yes. I remember now that you're mentioning that. Yes, that's true. I had a couple of battles with some of the stuff. But not with Betsy, really, because I think Betsy understood. You know, like, it was late 80s.
Yeah.
New York City. Come on. Like, at that time, the city was the coolest.
Oh, yeah.
Was the place, was the center of the world, I mean, if anything. And anything that was happening in New York. So, of course, I wanted the best photographers. Of course, I wanted, you know, like, the thing to be the coolest thing possible. Yes, there was. It was American Express was doing the magazine.
The
publisher was a bit corporate, let's say, but we went against that. I definitely wanted the magazine to be cool, to be like, you know, and quite fashiony at the time. I remember that's the first time I worked with Peter Lindbergh was at New York Woman, and that's the first time actually Peter Lindbergh worked in America. And then other photographers like Patrick de Marchelier worked there, like Denis Peel, Max Vadukol, Jean-François Lepage, you know, Jean-Jacques Cast, you know, photographers at the time that were working for Franca Sozzani, that were working in Europe. More actually European photographers, strangely enough. Because also, like, Mr. Lieberman was not happy I'd left Condé Nast. He said he had plans for me, and I didn't want to wait for those plans. And he was really upset. And I couldn't use any of the photographers that were working for Condé Nast. So I had to go in Europe and get the photographers from Europe, you know, like the cool ones.
Right.
So that was a battle, and I was winning that battle, and it was really cool. Like, I was bringing, like, all these newer, interesting photographers, and the magazine got noticed.
The magazine was stunning. I have been waiting to ask you this question for 30-something years. The logo, New York Woman, very long, elegant, serif face. The W in Woman was larger than the rest of the letters, and often in color. On the third stroke of the W, the ascender was cut off. So tell me what the decision was about that. So I'll draw it so you can, to remind you of something I have been obsessing about for...
Oh, my God. I don't even know what you're talking about.
I know you're not. Okay, so here you go. See?
Yes.
See?
Yeah.
How do I do this? It's backwards.
The last one was...
There was no tail.
I think that was...
The ascender... It was on every issue, so it was intentional.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was in part of the logo. That was the only letter.
I've been
that
obsessing was, about this. You have been thinking about it.
I don't think that was the only letter that was doing that.
The M must have gone. In the logo, it was.
The M must have gone that way too, no?
Let's see.
And the N as well, no?
I'm looking online to see.
No?
Nope. Just that pesky little leg on the W.
Well, I don't know why. Listen, I have no idea why.
The W and the W in New also didn't have it, but it was slightly connected to the Y ascend, the ascender in the Y yes. in York. Look at it and tell me, because I need to understand your thinking.
I remember clearly that I didn't like the fact like New York was written that big and that the name was New York Woman. It was too long and I wanted to make New York small inside the woman.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted that to be the logo.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Now your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
Hey, y'all, it's Elise. I have another podcast to tell you about. It's called In the Making. It's an original podcast brought to you by Adobe Express. It's the all-in-one content creation app included in your Creative Cloud membership. In the Making takes an honest look at the challenges and rewards of being part of the creator economy. The series kicks off with Puno, who is a creative director and educator. On the show, host Teresa Au explores how you can use the principles of design to create a career you love. Puno did it. Puno is a web designer and content creator. and the founder of an online education platform called I Love Creatives. And on the show, Puno shares her journey from working on the Call of Duty video game to building both a design studio and a trade school for digital design. Puno has practical advice for taking a thoughtful and iterative approach to career building. Most importantly, this show is actionable. It's about how you can take your own next step in the creative world and into the creator economy. It'll help you discover creative, intriguing people who are making a living, and it'll probably inspire you no matter what you do. I know it certainly did for me. Search for In the Making in your podcast player. My thanks to In the Making and Adobe Express for their support.
You mentioned crossing Alexander Lieberman, and you said that he was very upset that you left. He told you that he had big plans for you. He was crossed that you left, but he was really crossed later, really crossed when you turned down the job to work at American Vogue. So I guess that he revealed his big plan.
Yes, because when I left, he was crossed indeed. But he always said to me that the best way to move up in Condé Nast is to leave Condé Nast, to come back to Condé Nast. And that's what I told him when I left for New York Woman. But remember, Mr. Lieberman, you told me that the best way to go up in Condé Nast was to leave Condé Nast and come back. So maybe I'll come back. And that was that. That was my conversation with him. But in the meantime, he really had blocked me from using any of the photographers, which was good sport, you know, fair. Anyway, after New York Woman, and while I was doing New York Woman, because I think that was a year and a half, he called me in his office and he proposed to me to become the design director, art director of American Vogue. And I refused. I turned it down.
Why?
I turned it down because I felt the magazine was not in the right place. It was not the right moment. I didn't feel like the editor was doing the right job at the time. And I always felt like you have to work for the right editor. If it's not the right editor, it's not going to be right. Even though, like, you're in the right position, you get the right title, you're in the right place. But if the editor is not good, it's not going to be good. End of story. And at the time, it was Grace Mirabella, and I think she felt like she was on the last leg. And I think he wanted me there to help out, to redesign the magazine, to give it a boost, to do something with it.
For Grace.
And I felt like, wait a minute, if I go there and this is not happening, it's not going to go well, and that's it. You know, I turned him down. And it was quite ballsy of me to do that because, you know, like, usually you don't turn down Alex Lieberman. And it was a little bit upset. Then a week or so after that, I got a phone call. And I don't know if it was related through Mr. Lieberman or not, but I got a phone call from friends, from French Vogue. They were asking me to be the art director of French Vogue. And I turned it down as well. I felt like I didn't want to go back to Paris, giving up on America now, because, like, the, you know, going back to France would have been like, you have to go back. You have to be there. You know, like, it's not like it is now. Like, you can work from anywhere on the planet with a computer. You have to be physically present to make something happen. And I was really not in the mood from that to be back in Paris and work again in Paris. It was too early. It was, I think, like 4 years or 3.5 years after I was in New York. And I didn't feel like I had, like, made it in New York yet. So I turned it down. And, you know, like, again, I was not liking what French Vogue looked like. And I was not liking what was going on with that magazine at the time for whichever reason.
Did Alexander Lieberman think that you were crazy turning down both French Vogue and American Vogue?
I didn't discuss it with him, but I remember...
Did your friends and family think you were crazy?
Yes. Yes, my friends that, you know, that worked in the business and everything say, my God, you're crazy. You just turned down two Vogues? That's insane. You're crazy. Like, you should have taken that first one. You should have taken American Vogue. Nevertheless, 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, I got a phone call from Frank Castelsani, who was just hired to redo Italian Vogue. And that I took on the spot.
Because of Franca, because of the opportunity with Italian?
Because of the editor. Because Franca was someone that was really admiring for what she had done at Le and Pearl Louis, and she was doing such a good job. We were using the same photographers. You know, she was using Steven Meisel. I was using Steven Meisel. You know, like, she was using Peter. I was using Peter. Like, we were using that. I felt we had the same vision about things. And she was like a real true renegade in the way she would approach a magazine. And to me, that makes sense. This, like, that part is like, oh my God, I can't believe she's calling me. She was the one I was really like admiring. So it was not difficult for me to say yes. I didn't even think about it. I said yes. She said, like, you know, like, so would you come to Milan and work? Yes. I took the job on the spot. I didn't even think if it was complicated, if it would be pain in the ass to be in Italy. I just took the job because it made sense. What was interesting in all this, in the whole process, is to turn down two Vogues to get a third one and to get the right one at the moment, because Italian Vogue was the right one at the moment. Because what happened is afterwards, Grace Mirabella got fired from American Vogue, so that would have been my loss. French Vogue, the same thing happened at French Vogue. Someone replaced whomever was the editor at the time. And the whole thing collapsed, and Italian Vogue, on the contrary, it was like a huge success and a new thing. So sometimes you really have to follow your guts and your feelings about something and not get impressed by names and by surroundings just because. So I'm glad I made that decision.
Did you think that you'd be able to have more impact working with Franca at Italian Vogue?
Oh, totally. Totally. Because I think, like, she gave me carte blanche in the way the magazine could look. But she gave me carte blanche, but everything she was saying was ringing my ears like some like amazing music. Everything she was saying was right on the money. And she really was the one that opened my vision and allowed my vision to be expressed in a very, very direct way on the page of a magazine. She really was the first one who said, okay, do it. And she was behind me and she pushed me. She didn't settle for halfway. And all the people around her in her team, like Grazia D'Annunzio, that was the editor-in-chief at the time for the, you know, like the editorial part of the magazine. Everybody at the magazine were thinking the same. So you felt part of a team. And that boat was led by Franca Sozzani in a way that it was impeccable. And we were a perfect team going forward, going with the same goal and all in the same direction. And that was like, you know, it paid off. Franca became definitely the most thought after editor in the world for fashion and style. And she had a way of putting things together that were unlike anyone else.
Those magazines now are really considered collector's items.
Oh, totally.
The magazine sort of became a laboratory for edgy experimental photography and design. And you stated that when you were working with Franca is really when you learned about fashion. And I was wondering if you could share what was the biggest thing she taught you.
Well, I remember with Franca, she would take me around to see all the designers. And I would go to the shows with her and, like, you know, she would take me around and have the discussion. I remember when we did the first issue, she said, okay, come with me. And we're going with the magazine to see Mr. Armani. So we went to Mr. Armani and, like, we presented the magazine to him. And she was talking all in Italian. I was understand a little bit of it. I learned Italian afterwards. But it was really interesting to be put directly into the people that were making the fashion, like the designers, to be really working directly with them and to be part of the fashion system so directly. I think, like, you know, like the way she was working in unison with all the designers. she would like, you know, like, do always stories on them. And like, she was like really like, how can I say, like, she was, it's like, you know, she was like the head of a table, and she would like, you know, kind of like deal the cards, you know. And for designers, being in the Italian Vogue was very important. It meant a lot. And to have certain photographers shoot their story and their clothes, I think was very important at the time. It was really meaningful. And she was holding that deck of cards, and she would play hard. And she was really like a good leader in that. She was the voice of Italian fashion,
in many
ways. And, you know, to be in contact with her directly there was all what it meant, with all the people, that is market editors, like it is like, you know, like the fashion editors, or it is like all the people working for the designers. Like, you would understand the structure and how fashion was built. It was, you know, like, I remember going to Miuccia Prada and having this discussion with Franca there, and Miuccia talking to Franca in Italian, saying like, you know, I'm thinking I'm going to do a women's collection, you know, to Franca. And she was doing bags only at the time. And like, she had taken the business from her parents. And I remember very clearly the discussion she had with Franca. And I was there. And like, and I remember, like, I asked her, like, you know, I mean, if you ask me, I would say, of course you should do it. Mm-hmm. Of course you should do it. Because me, you know, I'm a French guy that lived in America and come work in Italy. You can do anything. Everything's possible. I also told her, like, yeah, I think it's great that you do clothing. Why not? And she was like, you know, and that's how, like, you know, that Franca was involved in this type of discussion with the designers. So I think she was really like, when you see like someone like Miuccia Prada, who had such an influence in the world of fashion, she had that importance. You know, I remember meeting with Dolce & Gabbana. I remember like, you know, meeting with everyone.
Heady time.
It was fantastic. It was fantastic. It was 2 years. But after 2 years of that, of being at the Italian Vogue, I think it was really difficult for me to go back and forth and to still deal with my clients. I had some freelance clients in New York. I was like 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there. And like, you know, at the time, I mean, it's not like I was flying business or, you know, like, it was not easy. It was much more complicated. You had to be hands-on, and like, I would be in Italy 2 weeks and I had to get my life there. And like, you know, but I was also like in New York, and it was complicated. It was complicated. And after 2 years of it, I left Italian Vogue to pursue other things.
Baron & Baron was born in 1990. You came back to the United States.
Yeah, that was after Interview magazine.
Yeah.
So I went back basically, and my friend Glenn O'Brien said, oh, you know, they're looking for someone at Interview magazine. And I thought, and it's a new editor, Ingrid Sisci. She was at Art Forum. Would you be interested? And I took the job.
And you've had a real on-again, off-again relationship with the magazine. She first hired you in 1990, Ingrid. But she fired you a year or so later because, this is what I've read, the graphics were dominating the magazine.
Yes, I guess.
And then in 2008, you returned with Glenn O'Brien and took on the editorial director role, which you had until 2018. What was that first year and a half like working to reinvigorate Andy Warhol's magazine?
Well, that was a very interesting time in the life of the magazine, because like Andy Warhol just died and Ingrid Sisci was taking over the magazine, and we wanted it to be different. So I don't think me and Ingrid got along really well, like in the direction in which the magazine was supposed to go. We didn't see eye to eye, and that's where I was like missing like Franca Sozzani. I was missing Franca like for our like distinctive and how like precise and how on point she was. And how like I felt like everything she was saying like was, oh yeah, that's golden, that's okay, that's working. When on the other hand, Ingrid's ideas I didn't feel were applicable for magazines in the same way. She had an approach that was not something I was understanding. It was not my cup of tea, by, you know, in a way. But still, it was interesting because, you know, like graphically and the way the magazine looked was interesting. So I was fine with that. But I guess she didn't think it was fine. I guess we didn't get along. I mean, we didn't fight. But she didn't understand what I was about. And I don't think I really appreciated what she was about either at the time. We got to know each other better after. She was still at interview. I was, I think, at Bazaar by then. And, you know, like, I grew to respect her. And she grew to respect me as well. We had different point of views. And that's fine. And that's why it's important, like, to go back to the point of view. For a good magazine, one point of view. You cannot have different points of view. That's when the magazine becomes schizophrenic and ununderstandable for people. And I guess, like, when that first interview I did, even though, like, I really liked what it looked like, it didn't make sense for what it was, for what she wanted to do. So I think, like, it was better we didn't continue together.
Was that the first time you'd ever been fired?
Yeah, it was. It was a strange feeling. I was upset at first, but then I'm bummed, whatever. Like, I had to move on. And that's where, right away, I started my company.
Right.
Like, the day I left the interview, I started my company. Because I was doing a lot of freelance anyway. So, at clients, I was doing Barney's, Valentino advertising, some Giorgio Armani advertising. I had met all these designers in Italy, and I was, like, doing a lot of freelance for them. And with all the other things, I felt like, let me start my company. Like, you know, maybe I don't want to work for magazines. Magazines are complicated. They really take everything under your feet. They really, like, grab all your energy. They require a tremendous amount of work. And they're not that good. So, like, I was really disappointed with magazine in a certain way. So I said, like, I'm not going to work for a magazine again. I'm going to start my company. I started my company, got successful right away, which was good. And I'd moved on. I moved on quite rapidly. And, you know, I remember, like, going to the shows and seeing Ingrid. And I was fine. Hello, Ingrid. How are you? Blah, blah, blah. And didn't all the grunge, you know, like, I was fine. I'd moved on. And that's when I got the phone call for Harper's Bazaar.
Yeah.
After, I think, a year after I left the interview, something like that.
Right. Before we get to Bazaar, I want to talk to you about just a few projects that you did back at the beginning of Baron & Baron. One of your first jobs was with Issey Miyake, and you designed his first fragrance. And you've said that fragrances are the strangest accounts to work on, that they are the most abstract form of advertising that there is. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about why you feel that way.
Well, at the time, you know, when Issey called, I know that Issey loved what I was doing at Italian Vogue. He said he was, like, really, like, impressed in the way I was putting the magazine together. And he said, like, we got to find a way to work together. I said, sure, lovely, that'd be great. Then I started my company. Then I get a phone call from him. And I said, Fabian, have you ever, you know, like, we should work together. Have you ever done a fragrance bottle? I said, no, I never done that, but that must be so interesting. But I'd love to do it. I love fragrance. I love the object by itself. Is really, it's the item that most people or a lot of people get access to. I find it a very democratic, you know, like, it's one of the first things you can buy from a designer brand is the fragrance or lipstick or, you know, makeup or beauty item. And I felt that was really interesting to participate into the vision of a designer and into creating this object that, if successful, can become quite cult, right?
Mm-hmm.
And generational. I mean, I was thinking at the time, like, Chanel number 5. Oh my God, what did he do for Chanel? Like, it's unbelievable. So I was really, really, really intrigued by the question of Issey Miyake and a bottle. So, you know, like, he said, like, can you come to Paris? I said, sure, I can come to Paris. He put me on the plane and I was in Paris. And, like, basically, like, we talked and went on to design the bottle.
Which is one of the most successful and long-running designs and fragrances of our time. And you've since designed over 40 different bottles for 40 different fragrances and have stated that one of the problems with developing a new fragrance is the name, and have jokingly stated that all that's left are names like Thief, Memory, Jealousy, and Pirate. Have we actually run out of names?
It's incredible, like, to name a fragrance is so complicated.
Actually, I think the name Jealousy could be interesting.
No, Jealousy is not bad, actually.
Maybe envy.
And I'm sure, but you know what? I'm sure that name is taken.
I'm sure it is.
Someone owns it. Like, every single word in the dictionary is taken.
It's crazy.
So either you go to whomever owns it and buy it back, or, you know, you kind of like put words together. Ultim Jealousy. You know?
Shades of Jealousy.
Yeah, Shades of Jealousy, yeah. But it's naming a fragrance is a nightmare. And I've named a few and it's a nightmare. It's really
naming anything is a nightmare. I've named some pharmaceuticals and it's a nightmare.
Oh yeah, no, but like the words are taken.
Yep.
Words are taken, and then, you know, like that's like something visual, like you can do something new. It's not like you can invent a word, even though like the car industry, that's what they do.
Yeah.
That's why some industries, they have to invent words that don't exist.
Right. That's the easiest way now to create a name, is to just make something up that has never been uttered.
Yes.
Oftentimes, though, that's hard because it ends up sounding so foreign that nobody really has any attachment to it.
Yes, and like the problem with the fragrance is like, you know, it needs to strike on an emotional level immediately. So that's the tricky part. Like, any emotion in the dictionary is taken for sure.
Right.
15 times around by 15 brands.
Yep. You also helped Calvin Klein relaunch, because I also didn't know at the time that his fragrance had launched to very little fanfare. You helped him relaunch CK1 and then went on to help shape everything for Calvin for several decades. Fabian, is it true you introduced Calvin to Kate Moss?
Yes, I did. What happened with Calvin, he called me when I was at Harper's Bazaar and he asked me to do his logo. He said, I need a logo to put on the back of the jeans and I wanted to say CK. Can you come up with something? And I designed that CK logo and he liked it very much. And that's how my relationship started with him. And then he started to say, well, can you look at different colors, that logo, because if we do on the back. So I came up with a whole range of colors and all, you know, like a whole thing. And then he called me for something else and then another thing. And then, oh, can you look? No. We are doing a jeans campaign, blah, blah. And I started working on the campaign. It went gradually, but like surely in the space of like 6 months, I came from not knowing Calvin Klein into almost living with Calvin Klein. It was an amazing experience because this guy, I just think like him.
Mm.
I just loved it. Everything he was saying. So like, I know what you're talking about. I know exactly what you're saying. And he was like so unafraid to try things that were not the proper thing to do. To do things in a way that were very visible, but with an extreme sense of aestheticism.
Mm-hmm.
And a very precise way to execute it. He understood media. He understood how to communicate visually a dream that people wanted.
How did Kate Moss fit into that dream? Because she was quite an unusual model for that time. She was not the face you would have associated with high fashion. She was short. Not short, in the grand scheme of things, but shorter than most models.
What happened is we had put Kate Moss in the first issue of Harper's Bazaar, in our first issue. We had leaned down the cover, but Kate Moss opened the first story of Bazaar. So she was like, she was already, like Bazaar's mascot. And then Calvin called me again, and he said like, oh, Fabian, like, I would love to use Vanessa Paradis for my jeans ad, but she turned me down.
Wow.
And And I look at Vanessa Paradis, and I look and I look at that picture that he had showed me. So it was a picture of Vanessa Paradis sitting down on the gray background and kind of like, you know, like crouching down with a pair of jeans and a white shirt. I think she was a T-shirt, something. And she was just like slouchy. And I said, wait a minute. I said, okay. I brought him Kate Moss. And the what I did is I told Kate Moss to come in the room and say, like, can you sit like on the floor, just like that picture? And she sat on the floor, just like that picture in front of Calvin Klein. And Calvin Klein turned to me and go, look, it goes like this. I say, yeah, see? And he hired her.
And history was made.
He loved her. But also, like, the thing is, like, Kate at the time was like, there was something like very innocent about her, but there was something very mischievous about her. There was like everything. She was like a flower about to explode.
Yeah.
I don't know how to explain it. And she was oozing cool by just being there. Whatever she was doing, she could sit, she could like stand, she could like, the way she would move, like she was oozing cool. And Calvin went crazy on her, like in a second, put under contract immediately. And that was it. That was Kate Moss and Calvin Klein moment.
She's written about how everyone thought she should fix her teeth, but you. What did people think were wrong with her teeth?
I don't know. I said, Kate, you're crazy. I love your teeth. Like, that's part of you. Don't change it. Her beauty is her imperfections.
Right.
Her beauty is that she's petite. Her beauty is like she has a little bit shorter legs. Her beauty is that she's a little bit that smile. She's a bit crooked. She's a bit like, you know, like is her imperfection are making her, you know, this most amazing person. And her soul is worn on outside.
Yeah.
And that you read that, you know, and that's what you see. So you're charmed. You're definitely charmed by her.
She wrote a wonderful, wonderful foreword to your monograph.
Yes, she did. That was so nice.
Your sort of comrades and being mischievous together, which is really lovely.
Yes.
So you've mentioned Harper's Bazaar a few times. I remember the day I got my Harper's Bazaar, that your first Harper's Bazaar, Welcome to the Age of Elegance, with the A sort of in Linda Evangelista's hand. It is one of the most glorious magazine relaunches of our time. You worked with the legendary editor, the late, great Elizabeth Tilberis. You and Liz completely revived Harper's Bazaar, and in doing so, created what many believe to be the most beautiful magazine in history. You've said that Liz Tilberis's real talent was that she was not scared of talent.
Yes.
Do you find that people in leadership positions are fearful or intimidated by greatness?
Yes.
Especially in the fashion industry, I would imagine, where it's so, holding onto a job is so hard.
I think a lot of people in the business see talent as a competition to their point of view. I think Liz was smart enough to surround herself with very, very talented people. And she would take everybody's point of view and make it her point of view. That's where she was amazing. And the only thing you wanted to do in her, all her abilities to do anything, she would do that with a smile and with lots of love. And the only thing you wanted to do is to please Liz Tilberis.
Yeah.
And to give her what she wanted. But she would let you use your own talent to achieve that. And that's amazing. She didn't ask you to be someone else.
How competitive was Harper's Bazaar at the time with the redesign and relaunch of Vogue that was happening with Anna Wintour?
It was war.
Okay,
it was
then.
War. I mean, like, you know, like, I think, like, the number of contracts between Hearst Publications and Condé Nast Publications for the photographers, the fight we had to get to the photographers, because I understood that, you know, we needed the photographers. It was really, really the most competitive time in magazine making probably that ever existed. And I did enjoy it. And yeah. I think we gave Anna Wintour a run for our money.
Oh,
for
without
sure.
a doubt. How did she react to Linda Evangelista being on the cover of Harper's Bazaar?
She didn't like it because, like, the minute Harper's Bazaar was happening, the veto was, the Condé Nast veto was, like, imposed.
Yeah.
It was like, this is it. This is war. And, you know, like, and the models wouldn't give up. So we had to do, like, we had what to do, like, everything we had to do, what to put photographers under contract, we have to talk to models, we have to talk to everyone. You got to do it. Like, it's very important. We're going to put you on the cover. Will you do it? Like, everybody was petrified to go against Condé Nast.
Right.
But we did it.
And you did it well. The interesting thing about Harper's Bazaar under your tenure with Liz was that it sort of juxtaposed two words that you generally didn't see together. It was elegantly provocative. You know, you were able to be controversial and edgy, but also at the same time, very elegant and almost formal in that.
Absolutely.
I read that one of your mottos, and I don't know if it still is, but one of your mottos at the time was to minimize maximally. And I was wondering if you can talk about how you know when something is minimized maximally.
Yeah. Wow. I said that.
Yes.
Well, you know, I think deep down I'm a minimalist. And yet, you know, like fashion, I mean, like Bazaar came about in the grunge years. So where fashion became kind of like more poor and more normal and more like real. And but then after that, you know, glamour came about again. So, well, fashion is not automatic. It's kind of a maximal thing. It's not plain and simple, if you see what I mean, like,
yeah.
Right? Even though you have like some Gilles Sanders and people like that, like, you know, that embrace that type of fashion. But in general, it's a world that is not subtle. I mean, Bazaar, we try to stay somewhere classic, therefore understandable. Yet, I mean, we pushed it quite far in some of the ideas that were kind of like extreme. So it was extreme, yet it was classic. So there was always that balance, and elegance was always part of the game, that it needed to be absolutely beautiful. Like, I felt like you could package any idea, as long, even if it was an art concept or something difficult to understand, if it was packaged in a beautiful way.
Yeah.
People would understand it better. It would be closer to them. They would be more acceptable. So maybe that's what I call minimal maximalism.
Minimized maximally. Liz Tilberis very tragically died of cancer. You left shortly thereafter because you were so heartbroken. Glenda Bailey took over, and it was recently announced that she would be leaving after many decades. A new editor has just been announced. I read that you were in the consideration for the editor-in-chief position. Is that true?
Yeah, that's what I heard too, but I never got a phone call. So I think it's all...
Yeah, all these different rumors that go around.
Yes. To be honest, I would have not taken it.
Yeah, I figured reading sort of some of your more recent thoughts, which we'll get to, about the magazine business, that didn't seem likely that you'd want to do it, but
no.
Back to the 90s, one of my other favorite projects that you worked on around that time, and one that I also own, the French version, is Madonna's sex book. Steven Meisel was photographing the book, and both he and Madonna wanted you to art direct it. And in your 2019 monograph, you talk about how one of the objectives was to give it the right kind of quote unquote, crazy tabloid elegance.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't make it too wild looking without making it look cheap. And if you mm-hmm. made it look too crazy, the right crazy, you had to ensure that the crazy was not going to be sort of ridiculous. How crazy was it to work on that job? And what did you think of the ensuing hysteria over
I mean, I had a great time. I had a fabulous, great time working with her. She was unbelievable. She was so...
I mean, was she naked most of the time?
She was naked. Yeah, not most of the time. But
yeah.
Some of the time, she was definitely naked. Yeah. Didn't bother me. didn't bother me at all.
Well, I would think the opposite.
I'm French, right? I'm French.
Like, how fabulous. So. But there was a lot of nudity. It was just nudity everywhere. Did it ever sort of get lurid?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, we took it as a job.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, it's like was working on a film or something like that. Like, I think like when you're on set and you have all these people, I mean, nudity is not something that is intriguing, really, to be honest. It's a job.
Yeah.
So you look at it as a job. You don't look at, oh, my God, she's naked or this. You know, we didn't care. Like, we were here to do something. And being on set, like, you know, doesn't allow other thoughts. You know what I mean? So, no, it didn't bother me one bit.
There was a lot of Robert Mapplethorpe influenced S&M, BDSM.
She wanted to cover a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
She wanted to have that bit, the S&M bit. She wanted the weirdness. She wanted the underground. She wanted the overtly pop culture. She wanted like the all the different aspect of sex. She wanted to cover everything. And I found like it was treated like a journal in a way, mm-hmm. like a thoughts, a thought process. And the visuals were like some of them very sophisticated, some of them very trashy, some of them very pop, some of them very cartoonish, some of them very hard, some of them like there was everything in it. It was like a, you know, like a collage of all these different visions done and packaged again by the same people, like a photographer, an art director, and a writer,
yeah.
Glenn O'Brien, myself, and Stephen Mazel. And, you know, like these different expressions of the subject matter, I mean, ended up being like the package was like together in a good way. It held together nicely. He had a voice. The whole thing had a voice and a point of view, and like visually, it was really controlled and really fun in many ways.
Yeah, I think it's
and
still
a scandal.
Oh my
and
god,
a scandal! When it
I
came
mean, I
out.
Couldn't you couldn't
oh
find it.
God.
I was finally able to get the French copy. I could not get an English copy. I got a French copy, which I still have. I was so enthralled with that book, Fabian, that at that time, you know, the internet and email and all of that was first taking off usernames. Mm-hmm. I used the name Dita as my username. Madonna's name in the book was Dita. I used that name. I thought, yes. I just remembered that as we were talking. I was so enthralled with it. But really, as racy as it was and as controversial as it was, and looking back on it now, it doesn't seem that way, but then it was. Every single photograph is beautiful. Every single yes. photograph is beautiful in that book.
Well, Stephen, myself.
Yeah. In your monograph, published by Faden, it's a 400-plus page stunning exploration of 30 years of your own work. And one thing that surprised me in reading it is your statement that when you were younger, you really loved being controversial and you were never afraid. And today, you find yourself to be more careful. And I'm wondering what is behind that change.
But if you see what's going on politically, don't you think you have to be careful?
Okay. I see. Well, I wasn't sure if you meant taking creative risks or being less maybe politically correct or...
Well, I don't think it's a good moment for that. I don't think it's the climate doesn't allow controversy. I think controversy is not read as controversy. Controversy is read as something extremely offensive and actually can put your career down today. So you have to think really twice about before you say something, before you do something a certain way, before you use certain visuals. You have to think about everything. Everything can become, you know, like a weapon against you.
Mm.
So you have to be very careful, I think. And it's somewhere it's good in many ways. It's good and it's necessary. In other ways, it's less good. It takes out a lot of the creative factor. There's it's never innocent, like when you do something, but there's a certain innocence in creation that doesn't put automatically things that you say or do in context of political or geosociological environment of a certain time.
Mm.
And I find you know, like certain artists don't live in their time. Yet they get judged per the environment and the context in which they work. And that could really endanger their vision, this kind of, you know, like restrictions, mm-hmm. you know, or self-restrictions one has to put on themselves to a certain degree. So being controversial today, no. Mm-hmm. It's very risky. There's that reason. And the other reason is, I guess, you learn. Like, I think when you're younger, you want to shake the tree. You want to bother the people that are older. You want to create your own little revolution. And then you become wiser and you don't want to shake the tree. You actually want to protect the tree. You want to make sure it's trimmed properly. You want to make sure it gets water. You want to make sure there's all the other things you want to care, you know, and you want maybe pass along a knowledge that you've amassed through the years, and you want to pass that along to someone else. So your behavior, your mental behavior is shifting and changing. So that's the second part of this.
Yeah. You've stated that the era of the fashion magazine has come to an end. Why do you feel that way?
It feels that way because if you see magazines, I mean, like, do people look at magazines still? Do people buy magazine? Do we feel in the age of technology, in the age of, you know, portable phone, tablets, you know, anything, you know, like digital, do you feel that turning the page of magazine is something relevant for today? Or is it better to swipe?
What do you think?
I think it's about swiping. It's not about turning pages of a magazine, to be honest.
Do you think that...
You may turn the page of a book.
Mm-hmm. But do you think that...
But of a magazine, I find magazine not relevant in my mind. I don't find them, you know, even though I miss them.
Yeah.
I do miss putting a magazine together. I miss working with photographers on editorial stories. But I don't feel it's relevant. I don't feel it's the proper tool to communicate fashion today.
Do you still subscribe to a lot of magazines?
No.
Which ones do you still subscribe to? Could you share?
No.
No.
No, I don't.
Oh, none. Yeah.
I don't subscribe. No, I don't.
I used to subscribe. I had a subscription to Vogue for 18 years. Like I just, like mm-hmm. I paid for it and there was a glitch with the payment and then I repaid and then all of a sudden then Bon Appetit took over from House and Garden. So I got the balance put on Vogue. I had it for 18 years and then it stopped and I don't miss it. I still think about it and I'll look at it online from time to time, but I don't miss it. I don't know if it's because Grace Coddington left. I don't know, but it's just not the same.
I think it's different time.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we were doing at the time in the 90s, that was relevant. It felt like it was something.
It felt like there was a connection. When Dominique Browning was editor of House and Garden, the first thing I would read was her editorial. The last magazine for me to go was Harper's Bazaar.
It's the tail end of all this. Like, I think people are just hanging on the branches, like desperately try to still hang on the, you know, like, I don't know. I'm not into it. It's funny. Like I think to do something that makes sense, it needs to be relevant. It needs to be a medium that is relevant. I'm way more intrigued into like, I mean, with all my clients, we don't talk about the page that's going to go in Vogue. We talk about like the Instagram post. I hate to say this.
Mm.
And even though I'm not, it's a shame that it is the Instagram post, but it's what it's about. So my question I put to myself now is like, how am I going to make that Instagram post much better than all the other Instagram posts? I'm going to make this relevant. I'm going to make this work. And now I'm going to make this like important. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Do you enjoy it as much?
It's different. It's a different process. It's a different exercise. And do I enjoy it as much? I don't know. I don't even ask myself the question because I think like you learn through you know, working, I've been working so much, you realize that most of what you do is problem solving. Problem solving, you know, that it is on the page, or on the screen, or on the billboard, or on in a book, or, you know, like on the, on, you know, as a moving image, it's you problem solving. And I became, you know, a problem solver.
Fabian, I don't think so. I think that you became a problem maker for other people because your work was so much better. And that's what I think great designers do. You know, even in your trying to do, when you're trying to make an Instagram post that's better than anybody else's that has never been done before, you're a problem maker for everybody else that can't.
Well, I don't know about that, but I know that's what I do all day long.
Yeah.
I'm being put like in front of a problem by a client, and I'm trying to resolve the issues that, and try to make the best solution out of it. And it's, listen, there's nothing wrong with that. And I enjoy that. It's kind of like, you know, like great math problem. It's also interesting, but it's true. Like the things I've shifted, it's not about magazine. Is it about a book? It could still be about the magazine that I treated a little bit more like an object, something that is less throwaway.
Right.
I'm talking about like maybe the biannual magazines.
Mm-hmm. Visionaire.
You know, like Purple, like all this, you know.
Are you aware of Stack magazines? It's a subscription service out of the UK, and they curate sending indie magazines once a month. Really, really, really well done. And I love getting them. They're never large circulation magazines, but it's really interesting to see what some people are doing.
So is it?
I'll send you a link. It's Stack Magazines. They pick the magazine. You get what they pick once a month. You get a magazine.
That's interesting.
It's really great. And then you sort of stay on top of.
You get an object? You get the object?
An object, the actual object. Yeah. The actual magazine. Okay. And there are some extraordinary efforts being made these days. They're small, but they're really, really good.
Yes, I'm sure. I mean, I think, I'm talking about magazine as a large audience, like the Vogue, the Bazaar,
right.
That level of magazine. Like, you know, ultimately, like, we love the small independent magazines because they have a voice and they have a point of view and they have, you know, something they want to say. But at the same time, they do it with no money and they let the photographers run with the ball and, you know, they undermine themselves before, you know, just to get like certain people inside their magazine. So it's a little bit of free for all. And then on the other hand, the very commercial magazine is the opposite. You have to do exactly what they want as if you were doing advertising, and your voice as a collaborator is not appreciated, or like you're here to fill in the gap, you know? So it's one or the other. I don't think there's any place where you feel like the collaboration and the point of view from the team inside the magazine is forward in a way that is, you know, like meaningful.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know a magazine like that today.
The one magazine I still really enjoy reading, both online and in hand, is The New Yorker. I still think that they're doing...
Well, they were very smart.
Yeah.
The way they did it, through like subscriptions. Mm-hmm. They decided like, it's not about the advertising, it's about like the quality mm-hmm. of the product and you know, for that quality you're going to pay a certain amount of money to get the magazine.
Yeah.
And it paid off for them. I mean, it's the one magazine at Condé Nast that is successful.
Good. In your monograph, you state that while you've devoted most of your life to becoming a good art director, you now want to dedicate the rest of what time you have left to film and photography. Tell me why.
Well, I think, like I said, it goes all the way back to my dad. I've learned art direction because I think he was an art director. He would have been a filmmaker. I would be in film, you know. So I realized that all the mediums are very much their own thing. And it's your point of view mixing with that medium that creates something exceptional. That it is magazine, building a house, painting, sculptures, filmmaking, photography. I think it's all the same. I think what you have to say is the important part. And how you're going to say it is also the important part. And the medium in which you communicate these thoughts is just that medium. It has its own vocabulary, it has its own language. So it's a little bit like, you know, like, let's say if magazine is French, you know, film is English, it's another language. It's like learning another language. But basically what you have to say is the same. You know, like most big artists, they just repeat themselves. Had the luck to be able to play with different mediums and to pass from one medium to the other, from magazines into books, into fragrance, into furniture, and into film. I've done film for about 25 years now. A lot of commercials, started doing most commercials. One of my first commercials was for Giorgio Armani, and then on for Calvin Klein. Like, I did many, many, many for Calvin Klein, and on and on and on. I just like love film.
What you did for Moncler, by the way, was extraordinary.
Oh, thank you.
If you can, I tried to write a little explanation in anticipation of asking you some questions about it, but I decided that it might be easier for you to just share with my listeners what you actually did for Moncler and that magnificent film in the icebergs.
Actually, the iceberg thing was a project that I had made for a long time. I went to, it was part of my sea pictures, and I was always intrigued by ice and by icebergs and these amazing landscapes that felt like they were another planet. And so I went to Greenland once and I took my camera, and I have a special technique when I do pictures that I do very long exposures. And then when I went to very, very long exposure, sometimes 3-4 minutes. And I took my big camera at the time, like it was an 8x10 camera, and went, schlepped it all the way to Greenland, and realized when I stand on land and the iceberg are actually moving. And I get my pictures back from my trip in Greenland, and you barely see it with the eye. I mean, you see like the little ice moving back, but the big things, you say like that thing's not moving, right? But then you get the picture back and you see a little blur, and you go, oh, everything is a bit blurry. Oh my God. Like, and I've been, you know, I said, I love this. How can I take a picture of an iceberg that is not something that looks like an amazing picture from National Geographic, that feels like my picture, and that has that amazingness, like something like special? And the only thing I could think about is that you need to lit the whole thing. You need to lit it like a theater stage, like you would lit like a street or something, because it's big.
Right. But there are no electrical outlets out in the Arctic.
Yes. So I said, oh my God, that's complicated. That's required. It's a big production. Da, 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 da. And then, you know, so years passed by, and Remo calls me and said, like, I love your pictures. I love your pictures of the sea. Dude, is there something what would you do? Like, if I would ask you to do something for me, what would you do? And I go, oh, you know what? I know exactly what I would do.
Especially given the brand.
I would
warm coats.
I would do icebergs. I would go to Greenland and shoot icebergs, but I would lit everything at night. And he said, okay, let's do it. And basically, he allowed that dream to happen.
That's amazing.
That was the most amazing journey and the most amazing job I was ever assigned. Yeah. I love that job. Me, the fashion guy, being lost in Greenland, minus 20 degrees, you know, with my camera and my huge strobes, like massive strobes that they were on boats, on other boats, and trying to take these pictures of icebergs, like it was heaven. I mean, like, thank you, Remo, for this. It was like really extraordinary experience. It was really great.
Is there anyone in the fashion or publishing business that you haven't worked for that could cajole you to work for them?
I doubt it. I'm
what a position.
To be entirely honest, yeah. I think, like, you know, like we were talking about film, we were talking about, you know, like what I've learned through the years working in magazines. You learn how to build a story. You learn how to make stories. You learn how to become a narrator. Then as I worked in film and doing commercial, you learn that same spirit of narrative, but you deal with visuals. You deal with the art direction. You deal with air, makeup. You deal with sound. You deal with special effects. You deal with color. You deal with movement. You deal with action. You deal with so many other layers. I find the film the most complete method of expression that, to me, is relevant for what I want to say today. So I've put, to be honest, most of my efforts towards that lately, you know, and I do a lot of films. I do about 20 different films per year that I direct. And I'm about to launching into a feature film. And, you know, like I'm in the works with that. So that this is something that's going to happen. And that's what is next for me, to be honest. That is what is going to replace the magazines. Yeah. It's the same thing, but it's just bigger. Right. It's just bigger. It's a bolder and more, you know, it's, and the narrative is bigger and like the expression is bigger. And there's, you know, like I'm someone with ultimate control in everything I do. And what I love about film is that you spend months and months trying to put something together that is in total control. But the minute you say action and the film is rolling, you totally lost all the control. And all the magic starts to happen. So all these things that you put together, you're really calculating everything. This is going to happen, this is going to happen. You're going to say this, that's going to be said. You're going to say that word. You're going to be like this. The color is going to be like that, da, da, da. You say action and it's like you're like a child in front of an image and something is happening in front of you that, wow, yeah. It's magic. And that, I think, to me, is the maximum. Yeah. So like I think that's where I'm going to focus the rest of my life, into doing that and my photography work and hopefully exhibits and things like that of my work that I've been collecting for the past 35 years without doing any exhibit, without doing any prints. I have like an archive that is huge and that I'm putting together and starting printing and like, so I'm going to start exhibiting.
Oh, so
those
so
two
exciting.
Things. And I really, that's where I want to go.
Congratulations. That sounds magnificent. So
it's great. I'm really happy about that. It took me a long time.
Yes, it seems to.
To get to that point.
That sort of seems to be the way it goes, I'm finding. My last question, how does your father feel about your career?
Well, my father passed away a couple of years ago, like about 8 years ago. And he was very pleased. He was very pleased. Of course, we were like
yeah.
this.
I can tell by your face how happy that
we
makes
were,
you.
We were very, 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 very close. And I think for dad, you know, for someone like him that really fought all his life to get where he was, and he was in a great place when he died, I think it was very, at first, threatening. Mm-hmm. I was threatening. And then I think he embraced me. And then he really, like, you know, supported me and very much like he totally embraced what I was doing and was very proud. Yeah, so he passed away and I miss him. I do.
And now you can infuse his work and yours into your four wonderful children.
Yes, I do.
Yep. Fabian Baron, thank you so much for making the world a more provocative and elegant place. And thank you for joining me today on Design Matters. It's been an honor.
It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure. And thank you for having me. I had a really good time.
You can see more of Fabian Baron's work at baron-baron.com and in his magnificent monograph, Fabian Baron Works, 1983 to 2019. This is the 17th year we've been podcasting Design Matters, and I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters is produced for the TED Audio Collective by Curtis Fox Productions. In non-pandemic times, the show is recorded at the School of Visual Arts Masters and Branding Program in New York City, the first and longest-running branding program in the world. The editor-in-chief of Design Matters Media is Zachary Pettit, and the art director is Emily Weiland.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.